Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music. And this one is, of course, its history with Follow the Sounds This Week in Music History. And, of course, to help me along with this journey through the past is my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Some situations you cause yourself, Brian.
And equally also co-host, Greg Harvey.
I'm just glad to be here.
So, are you? You glad to be here?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Greg was a little late getting here tonight, but that's perfectly fine. Gave us a chance to get together and, like, really put some notes together and put together a darn good show. And I just want to say, though, if you want to help out the show, you, of course, can help us out by going to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and clicking on the Amazon banner. It'll take you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping. Won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money back. It's that simple. You can go to the website, click on the banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And, of course, we'd also like to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. You guys are awesome. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Good on you for allowing us three crazy people to do a show about music. I don't think they really care that we do a show about music. I just think that they want us to do a show, period. But we are doing a show about music history tonight. And Greg, kick us off.
October 9th, the year 1965. The Ohio State University Marching Band take to the field as the Buckeyes take on the Fighting Illini. The Buckeyes had a dominating second quarter, eventually winning 28-14. And for weeks, a marching band staff member, John Tagenhorst, had been promoting a new composition. During halftime, the band plays Hang On Sloopy, Sloopy Hang On for the first time. Composition was an instant hit, and it has been played at nearly every OSU home game since. Always before the fourth quarter, and often the band's formation spells out John T. And then in 1985, columnist Joe Dirk began writing a campaign, that is. And on November 20th, 1985, the 116th Ohio General Assembly made Hang On Sloopy the official state song of Ohio.
Oh, goodness.
I was just trying to make sure I got through all those details.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
so that's really the state song of Ohio?
Well, okay, so officially... If you look in the list, it's the official state rock song.
Oh.
But if you ask anyone, what's the official song of Ohio, they all say, Hang On Sloopy. Like, everybody.
So, that's funny.
Yeah. It's a good song, though.
Yeah. And people, I mean, like, nobody, I think the official state song of Ohio is, like way on down on the Suwannee River, you know, something.
Yeah, like.
Something from the ragtime era that nobody talks about and no one plays anymore. So
speaking of state songs,
yes.
I know that we all have our roots in Illinois. Have you guys heard the Illinois state song?
Is it Dream Police by Cheap Trick?
That would be awesome. No. No.
They called it me in my bed. The Dream Police.
No, it's this song. It's called Illinois, and it's probably the weirdest, like, jazzy type song I've ever heard. Like, you can go and listen to it. You can search for it online, and it's kind of ridiculous.
Come on, feel the Illinois.
I was like, we could have done so much better than this. All the music to come out of Chicago, and this is what we get.
I was just going to say, like,
it's like freaking Georgia's got Georgia on my mind now. It's like.
I mean, I feel I'm a St. Louis native, but I would be okay with the official state song of Illinois being the Sweet Home Chicago.
I think there's like a rule against that, though.
Oh, no, there's no rule. That's a damn good song.
I mean...
Well, then why not go for like Fall Out Boy's Light On in Chicago?
For the rest of us downstaters, though.
Yeah, that's debatable.
No, it's not as good.
It's a good song.
Living downstate Illinois, though, you have to fight your entire life to not be boxed in with the rest of Chicago. And they would love it if that's what you did. Although, I will say Sweet Home Chicago is a pretty badass song.
Yeah, so, there you go.
I mean,
you know, I'm not from there, but damn it, it's good.
That is true, but at the same time, I agree that it would eliminate, or not eliminate, but it would piss off a lot of people if you changed the Illinois State song to that.
So. There is a awesome punk band from Carbondale, and they have an album out that's called Nowhere Near Chicago, and I think that should be in the running too.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on. In 1969, on October 9th, for the first time in the history of the show, the BBC's Top of the Pops producers refused to air the number one song, Je t'aimais, moi non plus. Plus? I don't know. Whatever.
Well, hey, when you're reading French, if you don't know what you're doing, just stop.
I know.
Just stop in the middle of a word.
I know je t'aimais, and I know moi. Because that's right. That, but yeah. I don't know, moi non plus. It was an erotic French language song by Serge Gainsbourg and actress Jane Birkin. The song, an instrumental with voices of Gainsbourg and Birkin, apparently recorded in the act of love, and superimposed over the top, caused such a stir in Britain that the original label Fontana dropped the record despite it being number two on the charts. A small record company, Major Minor, bought the rights and saw the song climb up the charts, becoming the first French language song to ever do so.
Boy, everything about that is just like dripping with erotic. Ooh. Like even the name of the label, Fontana.
Yeah, I know, right? I actually saw this article, and it commented that this song was the first of the, quote, orgasm albums to top the charts. And that made me do a Google search on orgasm album. Yeah, didn't yielded a lot of results. Nothing connected with this story, however. So,
it's for research.
Yeah, if anyone listening out there knows what an orgasm record is or album, yeah, please feel free to drop us a line.
I love the fact though that Fontana like dropped it. Like, you know, the executive of that label was just like, you know, some stiff upper lipped British dude who was just like, we can't have this smut on our label, drop this now. And so they get rid of it, and then of course some other company gets it and makes a crap ton of money off of it. That's how it goes. One.
Also in 1969, P.J. Harvey is born Polly Jean Harvey in Birdport, Dorset, England.
Good old Birdport.
You gotta love a Birdport. Harvey should not need really any introduction, but if you need one, let's start with she has two Mercury Prizes. Harvey is the only artist to receive two Mercury Prizes. Now, the Mercury Prize has only been around since like 91, I think. But still, like It's a fairly prestigious award that is voted on by music critics in the UK. So it's not like a popularity thing. It's not necessarily who puts the most money into promoting it. It's just, it's a critical thing. Anyway, so, but she got her first serious gig in 1988 playing with John Parrish in Automatic Dulmini. Now, AD is more or less the Neutral Milk Hotel of the UK, where it's often referenced but kind of rarely played. But regardless of AD's impact on music, her partnership with JP, get it? Huh? See what I did there? PJ and JP? All right, I'll keep going. her partnership with JP introduced her to photographer and, at the time, John's girlfriend, Maria Mocknes. This trio of PJ, JP, and Maria worked together on nearly all of PJ Harvey's albums, with Harvey the principal songwriter, Parrish the producer, and Mocknes as the artistic director. I would like to conclude in saying that the 1993 album Rid of Me and PJ herself are the two sexiest things to ever come out of the British House.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't say I'm too familiar.
With PJ Harvey?
No.
Oh my God. Big fish, little fish swimming in the water. Come back. No?
No.
No? Oh, my God. Okay, so PJ Harvey is, how do you describe her? So every one of her releases, right, every album release, she's kind of like David Bowie, where she sort of reinvents herself on every album.
Okay.
Right? So her first two albums are kind of punk, And I would say that Rid of Me is probably the best British punk album outside of something done by The Clash.
Oh.
Okay. Rid of Me is amazing. You have to listen to it. Then she, in 1995, did To Bring You My Love, which is like more of a pop album for the time. Now it would be an indie release, you know,
mm-hmm.
or an alt release. So the two big singles off of that was To Bring You My Love and Down by the Water. They are like, they have this gut-wrenching, weird grunge distortion on it. But the songs themselves are assembled like jazz pieces.
Hmm.
Really weird stuff. And then her last album that she just did is kind of like a big band Carmen Miranda. Like the lady who would dance around with a fruit in her hat, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like Carmen Miranda. It's like Carmen Miranda mixed with Tom Waits. It's really, everything she does always surprises me. It's always something new. It's another fresh take. And you never know what her tour or the next album is going to be, because it's just whatever her and John Parrish want to do in the studio.
All right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like I'm going to have to put PJ Harvey on my list of albums to do.
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
That'll have to do.
There we go. Just writing it down now. Bam.
All right, what else do we got for October 9th?
Here we go. October 9th, last story, 1984. Ringo Starr's greatest project debuts on British television when Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends airs on the BBC. The title character, Thomas, first appeared in the second of a series of children's books called The Railway Series. They were written by Reverend Wilbur Audrey and his son, Christopher. Now, the first book in the series did not have Thomas in it, surprisingly. The second book that came out in 1946 was so successful, it was actually the best-selling children's book of the year when it came out. Now, it came out at Christmas, so maybe that had something to do with it. However, altogether, there have been 42 books published, 26 of them by Reverend Wilbur and 16 by his son Christopher. The beginnings of the cartoon, the TV show, started in 1979 when BBC producer Britt Allcroft came across his first railway book. Now, cartoons are notoriously difficult to produce, so it took 5 years to bring one to television. However, just to give you a little bit of stats on the show, it's had 505 episodes aired to date.
Right.
And Ringo Starr did, I think, the first two or three series.
Mm-hmm.
And other people who have also done the narrator and Mr. Conductor as a character. Oh, although he's called Fat Conductor. In Britain, anyhow. Other people have voiced him. There's also George Carlin, Alec Baldwin, and three separate voice actors who, when you look them up on IMDb, have like the longest list of credits, because that's how voice actors go.
Yeah.
And their names are Michael Anglis, Michael Brandon, and Mark Morgan.
Nice.
Wow.
So there you go. Ringo Starr.
I always remember George Carlin doing it, and I always thought that was hilarious. It's like the one thing that he did to sort of be like a kid's thing, as opposed to the normal stuff that George Carlin did.
I know, right? It's a funny way to pay the bills when you're a guy who goes up on stage and is just as subversive as possible.
Yeah.
You know.
But I guess, you know, he had a soft spot for the kid stuff, too, so.
I mean, well, you got to pay the bills somehow, right?
Yeah, but I think that he legitimately enjoyed doing that show.
Maybe. So, and I mean, voice work in general is kind of almost always fun to do.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it can be arduous. Like, have you ever heard the lady who's did the voice of Siri talk about the project?
No.
Oh my God, it's like so grueling, because you just sit and read a list of words and try and keep the exact same pitch and timbre for every word.
Yeah, that's for something like Siri, obviously.
Right.
But in doing like most of the shows, like I've seen a lot of behind the scenes stuff on how like cartoons are made.
Yeah.
And for the most part, it can be completely insane, because you've got to say the line like 10 different ways just to give them, you know, something different, and then they pick whichever one they want. And it can be extremely grueling for the voice actors. But the one that I think I remember the best is listening to the guy who did Goku for Dragon Ball.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Because they asked him, you know, like, he's like, hey, what was it like to going in there and just like screaming for minutes on end? And he goes, Actually, I was going through a very bitter divorce at that time, so it was very therapeutic.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that makes sense.
Oh. And I think anyone listening to this has probably listened to outtakes videos on YouTube of different voice actors.
Yeah.
Those are great. I yes. love those.
Actually, my favorite ones that they do is voice actors doing lines to other movies.
Mm-hmm.
Those always crack me up. They do a lot of those at panels now for like Comic-Con,
yeah,
where they get a bunch of voice actors together, have them do their characters, and then read lines from like Star Wars or something like that.
I think that is one of my favorite things is when they do the like the reads.
Legitimately, hearing the voice actor do Winnie the Pooh reading Darth Vader's lines, I literally fell out of my seat laughing.
Ooh, Christopher
I could
Nolan.
Not breathe. That's how funny it was. Brilliant stuff. So
Luke, I am your father. Yeah.
All right. He's like, you have failed me for the last time.
Well, fellas, it's a brand new day.
Mm-hmm. October 10th.
Yes. The year was 1902. The man Orville Gibson opens the Gibson Mandolin Guitar Manufacturing Company, LTD, in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Kalamazoo!
Yeah. Hoppin' town. In 1936, Leo Gibson helps the world go electric. Gibson's first electric guitar, the ES-150, was produced in 36. And then in 46, Gibson introduced the P90 single coil pickup, which was eventually used on the first Les Paul model made in 1952.
Yeah.
Gibson.
I've always wanted to go to the Gibson, like, tour, you know, Gibson factory tour.
Yeah.
Always wanted to see that.
That would be great. I wish, dude, it's like.
All right,
going,
live on remote. Follow the sound.
Yeah,
let's go.
Let's do it. It's like going to the Anheuser-Busch factory and ordering a beer. In this case, we got to go there and get you a guitar.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
That would be a bucket lister.
Yeah. I've already done the Louisville Slugger factory, so. You know, I got to get the guitar one out of the way, too.
It's like the same concept.
And actually, yeah. On top of that one, I've always wanted to do, like, the Zildjian or Sabian cymbal tour.
That would also be sweet.
Of course, going to the Sabian one's going to be a bit harder because it's in Canada.
It's Canadian.
And not Ooh, just in
Canadian
Canada.
Cymbals. That's
not
why
just in Canada.
Anyway.
In the middle of nowhere in Canada.
What, like,
it's anywhere?
I know just that kidding. Because I've actually spoken with Andy Zildjian mm-hmm. of Sabian, like president and CEO of the company. I've spoken with him. I had him give me a suggestion on what type of cymbals I should buy in the future.
I do like how both companies, like the two main cymbal companies are like basically the Zildjian family, just
yeah.
split in
yeah.
two different directions.
So, but yeah, one of those would be on my bucket list. And then obviously, I mean, the Gibson factory tour has got to be amazing. I've got a Gibson acoustic at home, and I love that guitar. Yeah. Love it.
See, just owning a Gibson is still on the bucket list. Like, I got to get there first.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
I've always wanted to kind of remake Willie Nelson's guitar, Trigger. It's a Gibson classical with nylon strings. Mm. And then a really kind of rare, well, not common pickup arrangement where it's got like an aftermarket pickup built into it. Anyhow,
yeah. You think you can just go out and just recreate a guitar like that, Jacob?
Well, yeah, you can. It's not going to be cheap, right? Because neither of those are in production anymore, but yeah.
That is true. That is very,
they
very
did for
true.
Willie. He's got a second one that he never plays. That's
well,
not
yeah, but he's
up.
Willie Nelson.
Yeah, that's Willie yeah, Nelson.
They do that for Willie.
They do that for him, yeah.
Okay, well, that's it for me.
Moving on with October 10th to 1939. The real Eleanor Rigby died in her sleep of unknown causes at the age of 44. The 1966 Beatles song that featured her name wasn't originally written about her, as Paul McCartney's first draft of the song named the character Miss Daisy Hawkins, which doesn't really roll off the tongue. Miss Daisy Hawkins. See, it's just not the same. So Eleanor Rigby's tombstone was actually not even noticed until much later on in 1980 in the graveyard of St. Peter's Parish Church in Woolton, Liverpool. a few feet from where McCartney and Lennon had met for the first time in 1957.
Was it fate?
See, here's what I would really like to know. Did he actually see the tombstone, and then weirdly, later on in his life, it triggered Eleanor Rigby? Like, is there some type of story involving Eleanor Rigby? Like, was there supposedly like a haunting or something like that, and that's why the name stuck in?
The only thought that comes to my mind.
Or did he make it up, and it was just a weird coincidence that it happened to be there?
Well, what's interesting is that they say that the faces and the names you have when you dream are actual faces you've seen.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's your subconscious. Maybe it's something like that.
Could be.
Eleanor Rigby.
Either way, I really dig that song. I think it's one of their best. So it's,
I think it's the same as like Gwen Dibley's Flying Circus.
Yeah.
Right. So like Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Well, the entire reason as to why Eleanor Rigby sounds the way that it sounds,
yes,
was because their producer and engineer told Paul McCartney to listen to classical music. Because before, he would never really listen to classical music. He thought it was boring and outdated. So then he listened to it, and then he came back, and he was just like, all right, we need to do this song with like violins and cellos and stuff like that. And that's exactly how the song actually ended up being recorded that way. It's like the only just like classical instrument song that the Beatles did. Or it's like basically the only song that the Beatles didn't play on.
Yeah. Well, it's a good one.
It is.
It's worth doing at least once.
Yes, yes. I like that. Let's go ahead and move on.
Okay. Let's jump to 1970.
Sweet.
Right? Now, I love when governing bodies fight each other.
So, me too.
This is great.
Some real rock and roll.
This could be the beginnings of a celebrity death match. 1970, the FCC is in rare form, and they issue a statement that is just rock and roll as hell, or at least on the surface. In response to recent complaints by President Spiro Agnew that radio stations are Vice President Spiro Agnew.
How could you forget?
Spiro Agnew. You're right. You're right.
Spiro Agnew existed before you were born.
Had been making complaints.
Of course he did.
That radio stations were promoting drug use. And
yes.
FCC Chairman Robert Wells gave a little press release in an open forum letter that he wrote to Spiro Agnew, where he said, and I will quote, "If we really want to do something about drugs, let's do something about life. The songwriters are trying to help us understand our plight and deal with it. It's about the only leadership that we're getting. We're not really urging you to adopt a heroin distribution program, Mr. President, Mr. Vice President."
That's like the one time the FCC did something good.
I know, right? I know, right? And well, here's the thing. That's why I say, like, on the surface that it sounds rock and roll as hell, because at the same time, they're still, like, urging for more regulation.
Right. I tell you what.
But at least they're being a dick to Mr. Agnew.
The more I hear about Spiro Agnew, yeah, the more I just really despise this dude. And I've done my own research, like, after the fact.
Yeah.
This guy was just like, hey, you know, wakes up every morning, his head comes off the pillow, just like, hey, how can I be a dick today? Like, that's really what it was. Like, he just would go around and do stuff like this, just be like, condemn rock and roll, or condemn this, or condemn that. Like, never did anything.
Jeez, I know politicians like that now.
It's like, just cracks me up.
Personally.
I've seen a bunch of footage of him giving speeches and stuff. My impersonation of him is nowhere near what he actually is. He sounds so freaking plain. It's ridiculous. He sounds like the whitest white bread white man I've ever heard. That sounds like he slightly grew up in the South.
So you're saying that like Richard Pryor's white guy voice was understated when it comes to Spiro Agnew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember when Eddie Murphy did his white man voice, you know, and like, for the SNL skit, and was dressed up as a white person on the bus.
Yes.
Like, imagine that, but with like a more Southern voice. Mm. And that's, to me, go. Is what Spiro Agnew sounds like. Of course, I mean, it's not like, I've heard a bunch of other politicians back in the same time period. They all freaking sounded like that.
None of them
had any clue how to do anything that was even remotely emotional. It's like, I was watching the documentary with James Brown, and he was endorsing Humphreys.
Yeah.
And Humphreys, like, they start singing together, like, and they start, I Feel Good. And, like, it's just, it's one of the most horrendous things I've ever seen in my life. If that actually happened today, any politician that did it that sounded like him would immediately, like, be thrown out of the race. Unless it was Trump. Because we all know that Trump could basically say or do anything and nobody would care.
Well, I don't think people really remember how huge, like, Clinton playing saxophone on MTV was.
That's true, but he was good. He was better at it, so.
Well, I'm just saying that was the only, like, charismatic thing a president had done since Kennedy.
He tried to get that younger vote, so. Mm-hmm.
You know, and also, remember Michael Dukakis riding in the tank video?
Mm-hmm.
And that destroying his campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anyway. So even, like, Michael Dukakis tried to look like a badass. Didn't work.
That's why if I ever run for president, I'm going on air and playing drums. So,
yeah. Oh, okay.
I'm just saying. I'm going to do a drum solo.
Okay, Mike Huckabee.
Hey, he played bass, all right?
I know he did.
And he played bass like a goofy-looking white dude, all right? If he'd played bass like a cool guy, would have been mm-hmm. a different story.
Yeah, he should stand when he plays bass, for starters.
Well, he did. He just stands there with his feet together, and, like, that's basically it. He doesn't move or anything, so.
He looks like he plays in, like, a church praise band.
Exactly.
But not one of the good ones?
Not one of the good ones.
One of the, like, mediocre ones.
One of the ones that was thrown together for, like, a Sunday night service at a Baptist church with a total church population of, like, 80.
And he's wearing, like, orthopedic shoes Velcro straps.
Hey, Mike, you play bass, right?
You know what? Here's the thing. If you play, like, Michael Manring, where you just absolutely shred on, like, three basses at one time.
Or Bootsy Collins.
Yeah, where you can just Victor Wooten with two hands.
Yes.
Right? You can get away with wearing orthopedic shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care what you do then.
Yes.
Right, and mom jeans and a Jufro. You can get away with all of that and still be badass.
Yes. Absolutely.
Mike Huckabee, on the other hand, with his, like, very tepid rendition of Earth, Wind, and Fire, not so much.
Exactly.
And dad jeans.
Let's go ahead and move on. What do we got? Ooh. Let's see. October 10th, 1977. Aerosmith is walking back onto stage for the encore at the Spectrum in Philadelphia when someone in the crowd throws an amateur firework on stage. Remember, this is 1977. This is when fireworks could actually kill you. They've gotten a lot safer since then. So, this wasn't just some stupid, like, you know, noise-making kind of fire. I mean, this was like an M80 times three.
This is big boom.
Yeah, this was the cherry bomb that just, like, explodes everything. So the red cardboard tube lands on the stairs that the band is walking on, right between Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. The following explosion was powered by much more than 50 milligrams of black powder. It ruptures Tyler's cornea and cuts an artery in Perry's hand.
Wow.
The band skipped the encore and went straight to the emergency room. Promoters begged the band to return after nearly a year of talks and reassurances that Congress had made cherry bombs illegal. Aerosmith finally returned to the Spectrum.
Wow.
About 20 minutes into their set, a fan from the Spectrum's balcony threw a half-full beer bottle at the stage. The bottle, as luck would have it, lands on a monitor between Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, and Tyler was in the middle of a verse as the bottle shattered, and he suffered cuts to his face and inside his mouth. Perry was uninjured. After a quick powwow backstage, Tyler is outvoted 4-1 to abandon the show. The band gets into the limos and did not return to Philly for almost 5 years. There is no word on whether or not the band still thinks bottles are illegal. Or should be illegal.
Yes. So, all right. So, wow. 1964, Congress passes a bill called the Child Firework Protection Act.
Yes.
Before, I don't know if you know anything about what fireworks used to be made out of.
Dynamite.
Yeah, more or less, right? They used to be made out of black powder and other similar, like, low-grade explosives. However...
Nitroglycerin and sawdust.
Very close. So think about think about a cardboard dome, like two halves of a dome.
Yes.
One half filled with black powder.
Yep.
Right? Glue sealed off, the other half glued on top of it.
Uh-huh.
And then it's covered in sawdust and there's a wick place in it. Now, what is that?
That's a bomb.
That is a shape charge.
Yeah.
Because the other empty half makes a vacuum where gases get to escape faster.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a damn shape charge. So in 1964, they made the shape charges illegal so that you had to like fill the container with something. You couldn't, right? But then in 77, they actually put a limit of 50 milligrams. So, in 1977, before that came into effect, an M80,
was
a quarter stick of dynamite. You have no idea. I have no idea what was packed into it.
Yeah.
Because there was literally no regulation. Whoever was making the fireworks just decided what was in it.
It was almost just like somebody tossed a grenade in between the two guys.
Yeah.
My neighbor used to talk about when he could buy cherry bombs in Illinois.
Yeah.
And he would, because they had really long wicks, and he would light it, and then he would shove the cherry bomb into the crossbar of his, like, wooden swing, you know, like that, you know, like one of those, like a porch swing kind of thing. But it was like a crossbar that was, you know, maybe about 7-8 feet long. He said he would shove it into the middle of that, and then when it would explode, it would shoot fire out of each side in these giant, like, fireballs.
Wow. Yeah.
He said it was amazing. And I was like, man, that would have been great to live back in those days when they didn't care about safety.
It's a true fact.
I mean, we grew up in the 80s, which was pretty unsafe in general, you know, or for you, it would have been the 90s, you know, but...
Who?
But, I mean, still, it's like, we had the friggin'... Those big wheel tricycles that were dangerous as all get out. It's like, play with lawn darts.
Hey, okay. I used to just get in my red wagon and push myself down a hill. So
that's what we used to do.
Funny story, you mentioned tricycles.
Yes.
I just want to throw this at you. So my grandfather was a complete reprobate, had no morals whatsoever.
Yeah.
And was basically a thief. And he worked as a general maintenance man for Unit 10 School District, which included, at the time, University of Southern Illinois, Edwardsville. Mm-hmm. My tricycle had SIUE stamped on it.
Nice.
When I was a child. So I had like a 20-year-old super serious tricycle there. That thing was made out of American steel.
Legit.
Like, seriously, I've seen photos of it. I haven't touched the thing in I don't know how long, and I don't know where it is now. But it looks like it was made out of like an old submarine. Anyhow,
it was made out of spare parts laying around the old SIUE warehouse.
Damn, there.
Yeah, that's cool.
I was mainly talking about like the big wheel tricycles, which you know had the big center wheel. And then you kind of sat down on the ones.
I had a Knight Rider big wheel.
Oh, nice.
I was the coolest kid on the block, man.
Well, we used to...
it had a handbrake on it.
Yes.
Yeah, you could just completely get that thing sideways. Talk about drifting.
So we used to take like one of the one of those old like red and like yellow cars, like plastic cars for the little tykes or whatever. And then we would stack like stuff on top of it to build a ramp over... what is basically a dry creek bed.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because that wasn't dangerous enough, we stuck rake.
The one back there where your dog was?
No. This was my grandparents' house.
Oh, okay.
We took a metal rake. Not like, you know, the leaf rake, but I'm talking like the hardcore, like with the like solid steel.
Rake. Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, for gardening. and stuck that at the end of it with the spikes facing upwards because it needed to be more dangerous. Go flying down a hill, hit the ramp, and then see if we could actually jump over the dry creek bed.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny how you, at that age you just do not care.
I never broke anything.
I don't know how.
I don't know how I survived. Gosh. Did not break anything.
I did the same thing off a snowbank one time. And
awesome.
Like, I did this, what they call it, the scorpion, where you land on your chest and your legs come up over your head. And, oh, and I saw stars for weeks. And you know what? I just got up and walked it off
exactly.
Like a kid.
Because as a child, you were near indestructible.
Yep. Hey, okay. So here's another great story for you guys. In 1987, get out your sweet cars and let your supermodel friends roll all over them, because Whitesnake went number one in the U.S. singles chart with
Here I go again on my own, going down the only road I've ever known. Like a drifter, I was born to walk alone. But I made up my mind.
Okay, that's enough.
I mean, I think that says it all. And then in 1998.
It's one of those songs that's like literally just like it could come on and you know everybody knows the lyrics to that chorus.
Oh, yeah. Man.
I couldn't sing a verse for you if I tried. But that chorus, chorus, everybody knows it. And then like
something,
honey. Yeah. So that to me, that is one of those songs that will live on in infamy and will be played in movie soundtracks from that era forever.
Here's the thing. That song has one redeeming quality, and that it's if you're in a group of more than four people, there's one person there that hates it.
That's true.
Yeah. Well.
And the louder and more obnoxious you sing it, the better it is.
Yeah, I think we did a pretty good job.
I know. It's I guess I'm the one that has to get offended then. Even though I was part of it.
Ugh. You guys.
This song sucks.
Well, I tried to move on from it very quickly.
Sorry.
But you guys. No, I mean, it just that song has that effect. Just makes you linger. So, yeah, in 1998, something different happened. For the first time, Billboard does not publish a hot Latin tracks list. And do you guys know why?
No, why?
I think, Jake, you know the answer, don't you?
I do know the answer.
Yeah?
And that was, there was no electricity on the island where they would collect that data.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Hurricane George actually ripped through Puerto Rico on this day in 1998. And boy, this is one of those stories that feels awfully relevant in 2017 right now. Of course, we just experienced Hurricane Harvey and Irma and now Maria ripping through Puerto Rico. And so from Follow the Sound here, we thought we'd take a moment to just mention that there is still a serious recovery effort going on.
Yes.
In Puerto Rico. And, you know, despite what anybody tells you, it is part of this country, the United States of America.
They are Americans.
It is an American territory. And so, you know, it's hard to imagine. Okay, let's make it really real here for 2 seconds.
Go ahead.
It's pretty hard to imagine life without electricity, clean water, maybe even shelter, not knowing where food is coming from, not being able to get in a car and go to the next town over or check on people, you know.
Having almost zero emergency services available to you.
Really nothing.
Yeah.
Really nothing. And to think that this is a real life thing that's going on, like we said, here in our country, just seems unimaginable. But, you know, even for us that are sitting in towns like St. Louis, you know, you feel like maybe you can't help or you feel helpless. We did compile a nice little list here of some different organizations that if you do feel like helping, these would be some good ones. So the first one is United for Puerto Rico. This is the one that's actually being spearheaded by the First Lady of Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So this is a big one they're clearly pushing on that you know is actually helping because, I mean, come on, the Puerto Rican government supports this one. Of course, UNICEF is also active down there right now.
Great organization.
Yes. Maybe, and, you know, Halloween's coming up. Maybe you could trick-or-treat for UNICEF for that as well.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah. Another one is Center for Popular Democracy. We have Hispanic Federations. I believe it's pronounced UNIDOS. Also, the International Medical Corps. And then, of course, you remember with Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma, the former U.S. presidents all got together and had their One America appeal. Well, they have included now Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands mm-hmm. in that effort as well. A few more, too, if any of these fit your fancy. Of course, they're all great just to donate. But Catholic Relief Services is there. AmeriCares is there. Direct Relief is there. Save the Children is there. They focus mainly on the needs of families and children. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to make a real impact, you know, for the kids especially, that's a good one. Save the Children. And last but not least, Global Giving also has set a $2 million goal, which, you know, it's maybe not as much as the other ones, but it's still going towards the right reasons. So I would recommend any of those. And it just goes to show, too, that these things will keep happening, and we just need to continue to be prepared to help each other.
Yep.
I'd just like to add that since the hurricane in 98, Hurricane George, Puerto Rico's like economy never really recovered from that fully. It never hit back to where it was pre-hurricane status. They issued a lot of bonds and did a lot of lending. And John Oliver actually did a really good expose on that. And it's on YouTube, so feel free to go look that up. There's a lot of misconceptions about Puerto Rico wanting a bailout, and some of the, you know, these efforts, relief efforts, are being highly politicized, and they really shouldn't be.
Well, how long has Puerto Rico just wanted to be the 51st state, and we won't let them?
Well, that's a whole nother issue. You could do a Ken Burns documentary just on that.
Yeah.
Well, but
I think they're getting. I think, you know, even despite all of this, they're getting closer to that possibility of them becoming a 51st state. So,
well, and I guess my point with it, too, is that as much as they'd like to be their own state, I think it just would make it that much harder when a crisis hits and they need help from the U.S. government. And we kind of treat them as almost like another country, really. They're not a part of the United States, but yet what else are they going to do? Because they are.
There's a lot of really weird. Puerto Rico, unlike other U.S. territories, is specifically excluded from a lot of the fail-safes that we have built, you know, in the U.S. They're excluded for it kind of for no reason that anyone can put their finger on.
Well,
it's a bizarre situation that the Puerto Rico finds itself in today.
Unfortunately, I think there probably is a reason. It's just not an appropriate one.
Well, okay, fair enough. Like there was one that was there's a law that exempted Puerto Rico from being able to clear Chapter 9 bankruptcy in the 80s, and it was introduced by Senator Strom Thurmond. So, you know, Strom Thurmond, notorious racist. And just a crusty old man. So, yeah, maybe I'm sure that has something to do with it.
Oh, yeah. So just, you know,
Strom Thurmond's lifelong hatred of Puerto Rico, had something to do with it.
Yeah, the point is, have some humanity, okay? Just have some humanity.
I know that just from the, you know, lineup media, that the co-host of Two Birds on a Bat, Benji Molina, and, of course, his brother Yadier Molina, they are both doing a lot of stuff right now in doing stuff. I believe Yachty is actually down there right now, or if he's not down there right now, he was down there last week, just trying to help in the relief effort and stuff. You know, so some local guys, I know that, you know, they're originally from there and stuff, but, you know, but Yachty lives here, you know, and Benji, like, he's always around and stuff. You know, St. Louis is like a second home for him. You know, so those guys are out there doing some good and really trying to get some money flowing down in that direction. And I think that's a very good thing. So,
by the way, Brian, you got to get me in a room with Benji one of these days.
I mean, he comes into the office like every couple of weeks. And
like,
actually,
I used to play first base on my baseball teams because there was just too many Molinas to go around. So, they all play the same position. So
they're
gotta
all
put
catchers.
Somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. Weirdly enough, I mean, I know that this is, they've been talking about this before, but there is a possibility of Benji being around a whole lot more in the future. So, coming in on the Spanish side of the broadcasting. So,
cool.
So, I don't know if anything's set in stone as of yet, but I think it'd be nice. I love having Benji around, actually. Benji is seriously a cool guy.
Yeah.
He's extremely nice, and he will go around everybody in the office and shake hands and stuff like that. And if I ever wanted him to actually sign a baseball, he totally would. So there's that. I never have a baseball on hand to get him to sign, though. So I never.
Hey,
never
if,
get that
if I dragged him out in the parking lot and made him play catch with me, and I threw one like as hard as I could, would he be really nice and act like it kind of stung his hand when it really didn't?
Oh, ow, Jake!
Like, oh, wow, man, that, you got a real arm on your
crowbar there. I don't know, but he might. So, but
that would be a class act. Just throwing that out there for anyone out, Benji anyone is, who's ever played, like even if you played like double A ball, Benji, and somebody's is, like, hey, go throw the ball with my kid.
Yeah, ooh, that real just stinger, you know.
Yeah,
there,
exactly.
Jake.
That's a class act play. That's a Tom Hanks level like humanity play there. Anyhow, we got another day to get to.
Yes, we do. Okay.
October 11th, 1969. The great Muddy Waters, the man who invented electricity, is severely injured in a car crash just outside of Chicago. And that leaves three other passengers dead.
Wow.
So Waters, of course, he did survive, but he remained absent from music, recovering for about a year. And even afterwards, he wouldn't really stand anymore because he couldn't. He was just that wrecked from being in the car accident. So
that's incredible. Well,
yeah.
Four people in a car and you're the only one that survived.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been crazy. Now, of course, Muddy Waters, famous for a lot of great blues back in the day, is really the one credited with making blues electric and creating that Chicago sound that has become like synonymous with the city. And, you know, his biggest hit, of course, being Hoochie Coochie Man. So I've always been a fan of Muddy Waters. That dude was just great. So and he lived a good long while, so. Produced a ton of music and basically shaped the way that all music is then done later on. Rolling Stones directly influenced by him, and in fact, like, were massive fans of his. So if you ever see the movie Chess Records, there's actually a scene in there where the Rolling Stones meet him, like, outside of Chess Records, and they're like, oh my god, it's him. So
that's cool.
And if you listen to early Rolling Stone stuff, it's basically all just copying Muddy Waters.
Oh, yeah.
They just couldn't sing like him. Mick couldn't sing like him. So he just sang the way that he could, and that's how it ended up being. So there you go. That was a crazy, crazy little thing for him, though.
Well, a mere 6 years later, in 1975, Saturday Night Live, at the time simply called Saturday Night, made its debut on NBC. Now, when I think of Saturday Night Live, I can't forget the music acts. I always think of who's going to be the music guest.
It's one of the best introductions to America. Like, if you can be a musical guest on Saturday Night Live, you instantly know that you're going to get like a lot more fans.
Yeah,
like, because it's a huge fan base, and I mean, so many great acts on that show over the decades. Just,
yeah,
so
and we'll
many.
Get into that. But
yes.
So at the time, when it first launched, the format was longer.
Yeah.
It wasn't an hour long show, it was an hour and a half.
Yeah. Well, I thought it still is, isn't it?
No, it's an hour now, isn't it?
I thought it was still an hour and a half.
I thought it was always an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But I haven't kept up on it as much.
I'm crazy then.
Maybe they changed it recently, but I thought for sure it's always been an hour and a half.
Isn't it like 10:30 to midnight?
Mm-hmm.
Central time?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, because the 10 o'clock. Okay.
After the 10 o'clock news?
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
never mind.
But it's Saturday night.
That's fine.
Do they have 10 o'clock news on Saturday?
I don't know. Get on with it.
The point is that they had two music acts for the first few episodes. So Janice Ian came on and played at 17 and In the Winter, and Billy Preston was also on the show, and he played Nothing for Nothing and Fancy Lady.
Nothing from nothing mean nothing.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you think of music acts, Greg, on Saturday Night Live, like, what's the first person that pops into your mind? What's the first, like, group that...
Honestly, I'd say either Steve Martin playing his banjo, or I would think of a lot more recent stuff, because I think, like, Gautier popped in my head.
That was a good episode.
Being on Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Yeah, that was good.
I don't know why he popped in there, but I think his performance just really stood out to me for some reason.
I remember seeing after the fact Elvis Costello's performance, and that one blew me away. I loved that one. And then of course you've got other ones like I can't even think of them. I honestly can't even think of like all the great ones that I've seen. There's just too many of them.
I think I remember like Maroon 5 when they first came out with Songs About Jane.
Yeah.
I think they were on at one point. Because for me, especially in college, Saturday Night Live, and you were kind of getting about recent years, like, well, their introduction, you know, with the music. I would always enjoy watching their live performances, because when you look up a band and you go through like some of their studio stuff and then you'd like to see some of their live stuff, Saturday Night Live was usually a good place to see a live performance that had a good sound quality and wasn't drowned out by audience, and it wasn't ruined by, you know, just a handheld camera with poor quality. Mm-hmm. It was a good quality live performance that you could see how these bands really sounded. Maybe even get a feel for if you'd actually want to buy a ticket to see them, too.
Don't forget, I mean, it's also responsible for Ashley Simpson basically losing her career. Because she didn't perform live.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we've said it before, especially here in St. Louis. You gotta wow us.
Yeah.
You gotta put in the effort if you want to be a performer.
I think the most recent one that comes to my mind where I was like, man, not only was that a great performance, but it's about time, was A Tribe Called Quest. When they came on, I was like, oh my God, they should have been on this show 20 years ago. Not 2017. They should have been on here like 87.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, yeah.
Anyhow, 30 years ago, I guess, but that, and I think of, I remember hearing that Sun Ra was on Saturday Night Live, and Sun Ra was a really weird guy, who when he says that he came from space, I believe he actually thinks that.
Sun Ra is not the one, okay, I'm thinking of something else, I'm thinking of the guy, you know, I am the god of hellfire.
No.
I forgot who that guy is.
Sun Ra.
Bree, yell at your speaker now.
What's the worst SNL performance then? Ashley Simpson?
Ashley Simpson's got to be on there.
What else?
Honestly, I remember seeing Fall Out Boy on there, and they were horrendous.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I don't know what it is. I've never been a huge fan of Fall Out Boy's live performances because it never sounds right. It always sounds weird to me, or something's not right or mixed right or something. So.
I can't think of anyone that really phoned it in. Like, I watched them and went, wow, this was just, they didn't want to be here.
Yeah.
There's been some acts that, like, the music didn't resonate with me.
Well,
but,
yeah.
But for the most part, it's when they get, like, some super experimental group on there that's when I'm like, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, I don't care about this. But there's just too many really, really good performances on there. Like, wasn't it recently that they had,
you know what?
Like Miley Cyrus and
Siley Myrus.
I got that right. But it was Miley and Adam Sandler. What didn't they do a thing on that, or was that something else?
I do believe they did something. See, yeah, that's the thing too, is mixing up performances on other shows.
That's true. Well, I guess because the Adam Sandler thing like kind of stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Then that being said, Adam Sandler's performances on SNL are still classic songs. So.
Yeah.
I still crack up every time I hear, you know, the Lunch Lady song, so. Sloppy Joe, Sloppy Joe.
Well, hey, this next story.
Go ahead.
Is my favorite story of the show.
Well, and
because I get to say.
Write this one down.
On October 11th, 1981, opening a show for the Rolling Stones in his hometown of Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Minneapolis.
Prince gets booed off the state.
What?
Wow.
The Stones had like some good intentions of bringing up a young local talent to play for the show, but his act was certainly not a good fit for the crowd. When he opened his trench coat to reveal that he was wearing bikini briefs, the crowd got kind of ugly. And that was the last time Prince actually performed not as a headliner.
Interesting.
Wow.
So, I just recently watched a documentary on the Rolling Stones.
Yes.
And it kind of really gave me a new respect for the band. I still don't necessarily like care for all of their music, but it gave me a new respect for the band themselves.
Nobody actually cares for Voodoo Lounge.
So.
Hey, that's not true.
What?
But at the same time,
that had Love Is Strong on it.
Ugh. 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 Choke me with some Geritol.
But
I imagine it that's like Rolling Stones in front of a fireplace, you know? Go on, Brian.
So I just gave me a new respect for the band and kind of like the process that they've taken to get to where they are. And they're still one of like the top touring groups, you know, in the world. But just the fact that they had Prince open for them, like, you wouldn't think that would be that like much of a mistake, you know?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a problem when you ask Prince to open up a hometown show for the Stones.
Yeah. And so
rock and roll,
like it, but it does kind of, if you think about it, it does kind of have that vibe of Jimi Hendrix opening for the Monkees. You know, like it's that kind of a setup if you actually like think about it.
Right.
But Rolling Stones fans, like I can see how they, you know, wouldn't really get Prince.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, because the Rolling Stones are always supposed to be like the bad boys, you know, even though like by the time they got into the 70s, they weren't really the bad boys anymore, but like they definitely like that's their vibe. And so to have Prince come on there, who is not really a bad boy, but I mean, obviously he's pushing boundaries and stuff like that in his performance, you know, wearing what, bikini briefs and stuff. But he doesn't have that vibe at all.
Well, the blunt of it is it's 1981 and Prince was too feminine for that crowd.
Yeah, which is even more amazing because then later on Prince becomes, you know, like this sort of sex icon.
Yeah, but he's
with the ladies. So
Prince is interesting because he's always been like the metro sex icon, like the straight man mm-hmm. who like could be a gay man. But it doesn't matter because he's just a sexy man. You know? It's like David Bowie.
Yeah. I could see that.
Anyways. Yeah,
I've been looking this whole time to try and find this guy's name. But, all right. So, I met him through my dad. They were both working on a project at a studio at the same time. But one of Prince's early bass players. Right. I met the guy. Can't remember his name now. But his career with Prince was summed up in one sentence that he said to me. He said, he's like, yeah, man, when Prince wanted me to start wearing, like, assless pants, chaps, then I had to leave. Like, it was when he was trying to get the rest of his band to wear, like thong underwear and chaps.
I mean, have you seen those music videos?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go ahead and close out October 11th.
Oh, okay.
With 1990, the drummer, Dave Grohl, played his very first gig with Nirvana when they appeared at the North Shore Surf Club in Olympia.
What? Sweet. Dave Grohl. Oh, yeah. Fist pump.
That's all I got. I just wanted to put that one in there because
that's great.
You know, I think of like all the sort of like 90s rockers that Dave Grohl has aged the most graciously, which is kind of funny.
That's true. He's
like the cool
dude.
Grandpa. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. He's definitely like more and more rock and roll dude the older he gets.
You know, it's true.
It is true. I mean, at least so far. So, way to go, Dave Grohl. And it's another new day.
It is. It's a new day. This one's a little long, but I think it's really worth it.
It's time for the Fireside Chat with Jacob Crum.
Stop me if you've heard this before.
Go get yourself
But in
some
1957,
popcorn.
On October 12th, Little Richard renounces rock and roll.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I knew that one.
You've heard this one?
Yeah, you know why? What's even funnier about this story is that he took all of his jewelry.
Hang on, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to get to that. So Tutti Frutti was released in 1955, and with it, Richard caught fire. In 1956, he had 9 top 10 singles, and 18 months after Tutti Frutti was released, he had earned a rumored $18 million in record sales. That's $1 million a month in 1950s money.
Mm-hmm.
That's insanity. All right. So, in fact, the only market that had a mediocre response to Richard was Australia, which had been very difficult for American artists to break into. The plan was for Richard to play 14 shows in 2 weeks and spearhead an American musical invasion. But, as they say, the best laid plans of mice and men just get fucked up by the weather. The plane that Richard was flying on was struck by lightning and one of its engines burst into flames.
Wow.
The pilots were able to extinguish the fire with a dive. However, this had a side effect of scaring the shit out of the passengers. Also during the flight, Richard saw a ball of fire shoot across the sky. The date of this flight was October 4th, 1957. Coincidentally, the day Sputnik was launched into space. Little Richard saw the rocket carrying Sputnik fly into space and got supernaturally terrified by it. It had quite the effect, and he told a crowd in Sydney on October 12, 1957, he said that he had, quote, dreamed of his own damnation as he prayed while the plane was on fire. He then said that he was giving up rock and roll after this show to, quote, if you want to live with the Lord, you can't rock and roll too. God doesn't like it, end quote. Now, as the myth continues, after that show, Richard tossed 4 diamond rings into the Hunter River that night and devoted himself to the ministry.
Yep.
And became a reverend and refused to play anything but gospel music. His label hated him for it, and there was a brief stalemate as Richard refused to record anything but gospel music, but the label kept releasing previously recorded rock and roll recordings for the next couple years. In fact, Good Golly Miss Molly, one of his most famous recordings, was released after this concert. Richard spent the next, 4 or 5 years being a minister, and eventually he was introduced to Quincy Jones and began recording gospel music with Quincy Jones. And some of those recordings for N Records are the absolute gold standard for gospel music. The team of Little Richard, Quincy Jones, Mahalia Jackson, another R&B artist mm-hmm. who had quit making R&B music and devoted herself to gospel, and George Goldner were gospel music in the 60s. If you haven't looked it up, you should definitely try it. Even if you hate gospel music, just take a listen to it, because it's Little Richard, right? And Quincy Jones, it can't be bad.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1962, Richard returned to rock and roll with a European tour, and joining him on the second leg of that tour at the Tower Ballroom in New Brighton was a brand new group managed by Brian Epstein. You might have heard of them. Their name was the Beatles.
Yep.
Mind blown.
All right. So, I, funnily enough, know all about this.
Yes.
Because I've seen a bunch of random documentaries about it. The joke being that a lot of people were pissed off at Little Richard because he devoted himself to the ministry and he threw all of his jewelry into the river and he didn't tell anyone where he threw it in at. So that's why people were mad. They weren't
Little
mad that
Richard's
he gave up.
Treasure.
They weren't that mad that he gave up the music. They were mad that he threw his jewelry away and nobody could find it.
Gather around for the tale of Little Richard's treasure.
So here's
Richard. Next time you throw $8,000 worth of diamonds into a river, can you give me a clue first? Just a heads up.
Just a crude drawing on a napkin would work.
I'll let you have your moment before I go looking for him.
So the other funny thing about this story is its conclusion at the end, where he plays and the Beatles open for him.
Mm-hmm.
Fact of the matter is that the Beatles actually learned from Little Richard some of their quintessential things that became parts of the Beatles' repertoire later on. Like the fact that whenever they do the ooh, like at the end of a phrase, Little Richard did that. And he even joked that those Brits stole my wop bop loo bop and my woo. Because if you ever notice it, when the Beatles do it in some of their earlier TV performances and stuff, when they do that, they shake their heads. And they shake their heads exactly like Little Richard used to do, except for the fact that they had the mop tops, and so their hair went crazy, and Little Richard's hair stayed in place.
Because he had a helmet.
Because he had a helmet of pomade.
So Little Richard, really wild guy, has led a really wild life. And even just like his taking a break from his wild life was crazy
wild.
As shit.
Yeah. So, but it is fascinating. This is actually considered the dark period or a dark period of rock and roll. Do you know why? No? Yeah.
No.
Okay. So what it is, Little Richard.
Yes.
Gives up music, mm-hmm. goes into the ministry. Elvis. Goes into the military. He gets drafted.
Oh.
Chuck Berry. Oh. Arrested.
Yes.
Ooh.
And like a whole other group of people, like Jerry Lee Lewis. That's when everybody finds out that
yes.
he's married to his cousin and Ooh. She's a child.
Oh.
And then like just one thing after another. Mm-hmm. Basically all of the rock stars or the rising rock stars at that time, something happens to them. And they are taken out of the mainstream. And that's why, like, Johnny Cash, who was more on, like, the countryside, he kept going and doing stuff. And then, like, Carl Perkins kept going and doing stuff. But, like, the ones who are truly in the rock and roll, like, they basically they basically all got knocked out. And it is directly responsible because like, afterwards, nothing was really getting produced. You know, yeah, there was some stuff. But it was the earlier stuff that then influenced the Brits, who got it a couple of years later, and then that's where the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and like all of these other bands came from, was because of this earlier stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like McCarthyism got its birth in like 1954,
mm-hmm.
and it took a while to steamroll its way through different media sources.
Yes.
So, you know, 1957, like Hollywood's got its blacklist, Elvis gets drafted. Depending on who you listen to, it's plausible that his name was not picked out of a hat.
Yeah.
That it was written down by somebody who was a friend with McCarthy. That, like, government censorship in the U.S. was really flowing at the time.
Yeah. So, there you go. It's considered the dark period of, one of the dark periods of rock and roll, at least the early one, so.
Mm.
But it led way to basically the British invasion that happened later mm-hmm. on, or at least the first British invasion.
You know, Little Richard, when he came back into rock and roll and had a whole nother audience because he had people in the South that were listening to nothing but gospel music who were like, well, you know, maybe I want to hear this guy's voice sing something else.
Exactly.
Anyhow.
I still love Little Richard's voice. That man had some vocal runs that just put everybody to
Honestly,
shame.
I just like the guy.
Yeah, he's a cool dude in general, so. Let's go ahead and move on. October 12th, 1969, a DJ on Detroit's WKNR radio station receives a mysterious phone call telling him that if you play the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever backwards, you hear John Lennon say the words, "I buried Paul." This started the worldwide rumor that Paul McCartney was dead.
He is.
So I'm going to tell you this, just from my interactions with Eric from Surreal Talk, he does mm-hmm. not believe Paul McCartney died. He believes Paul McCartney is the exact same person that he was back then. Everett from Surreal Talk has a completely different thing in that even if he did die and they replaced him with somebody else, that's the Paul McCartney we've had for this, you know, 40 years now. And that's the one we like. So therefore, we're sticking with him.
Yeah.
So even if he did die and was replaced, it still doesn't matter. We still like the guy.
So Paul McCartney was spotted at a Circle K in Springfield, Illinois, going to the bathroom. And that was like just a few years ago. So I know that he exists because we have seen
his urine.
We have seen.
This is the urinal that Paul McCartney went in.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I had to go in there and, like, restock the beverage cooler once, and I kept telling my coworkers, I was like, you guys, did you know that in this very bathroom, Paul McCartney stood? I was like, I'm not kidding you. I'm totally serious. They're like, shut up. I was like, yeah, but it really did happen, though.
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
At the Circle K.
Here's
Paul McCartney,
story,
the Circle K.
All right. Also on October 12th in 1978, whilst living at the Chelsea Hotel in New York City, of which if you don't know anything about the history of the Chelsea Hotel, y'all need to find out. The Chelsea Hotel is like where just a ton of insane things happened. It's where all the rock stars stayed when they went to New York. And you can still like go see the building and stuff where it is and just... complete and total insanity. So check out the Chelsea Hotel.
Ask for the rockstar treatment.
So, 1978, whilst living in the Chelsea Hotel in New York City, Sex Pistol Sid Vicious called the police to say that someone had stabbed his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen. He was arrested and charged with murder and placed in the detox unit of the New York prison. Unfortunately, Sid Vicious died of a heroin overdose before the case went to trial. I honestly believe he killed her. He probably did it in a drug-induced, you know, stupor or whatever. But I believe he did it. I believe he killed her.
They're pretty messed up.
Yeah. I mean, he could have been totally high and hallucinating and then, you know.
Or he could have just wanted to kill her.
Yeah, or he could have just done it anyway. But, I mean, he was probably high either way.
Well, that's true.
So.
False flag operation.
Yeah, I totally believe he killed her.
Well. We'll never know.
No, we won't.
One of life's mysteries, Sid Vicious. Did he commit a vicious crime?
Ooh.
We'll never know. His name implies so. Hey, so here's a fun fact, gentlemen. You ready for this one?
Go for it.
1996. The charts, right? U.S. album charts. Tell me which one of these things is not like the other, okay? The number one album... in 96, Celine Dion, Falling Into You.
Oh, I remember that album. Didn't enjoy it, but I do remember
but
that.
But there it was.
Yeah. Also, not an easy song to sing. That her Titanic song?
What, My Heart Will Go On?
Yeah. That is a difficult to tell song to sing. Anyhow.
The little flute part's difficult.
Penny whistle.
No, it's just hard to sing.
Is that a penny whistle?
It's a penny whistle, yeah.
Wow.
I know this for a fact because my dad learned it on Penny Whistle.
Now, see, a Penny Whistle would make sense because they would have had that on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, okay, so Celine Dion's holding down number one. Mm-hmm. Number two in the country, Mr. Kenny G.
Oh, yeah.
The moment.
Are we sure this is not like the adult contemporary charts?
Well, now hold on.
Okay.
See, there's one of those things. Kenny G is insanely popular, and yet, like, nobody admits to buying his music.
Oh, I know we had Kenny G around my house growing up.
Him and Yanni. Yeah. Like, nobody admits to buying their albums, and yet they have number one albums in the country, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, I remember that one song that goes... Oh, I guess that's all of them, isn't it?
At least Yanni's like, you know, super skilled, you know, and
okay,
like, he's a great.
Okay, so Celine Dion,
here's the big reveal. Yeah. Celine Dion's number one, Kenny G's number two, and number three, holding it down, Marilyn Manson.
Oh,
Antichrist Superstar.
Not even the cover. Not even the
head
cover.
Head to head with Kenny G.
Wow.
So there you go, folks. A little easy listening for you.
Wow. Man, 96 was a
hell of a year.
Weird year.
Weird year. Mm-hmm.
Hell of a year. Oh, and only one short year later, Brian.
Yeah. Oh, man, this was a sad day in music. In 1997, on good old October 12th here, we have John Denver dying in his handmade experimental airplane. It was a glider, actually. And when it was a glider, but it had like a separate engine like on it, so he could get up and then he could do some stuff.
Okay,
and,
yeah. You know,
at least that's what I believe it was. I could be mistaken. If I am, then
it's almost like an ultralight or something.
Yeah, something like that. But it ran out of gas and he crashed off the coast of Monterey Bay, California. The 53-year-old star had scored 15 songs in the Billboard Top 40 pop charts, 10 of which reached number one on either Billboard's Adult Contemporary or Country chart. And it was a sad day because the guy just like produced such good songs and not just like, you know, good musically and good vocally, but just good wholesome music, you know, that made you feel good, made you feel happy to be alive. And he recorded a documentary shortly before he died of him going down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon and stuff, like with his family. And he recorded a song that he only played like there, like on the show or on the documentary or whatever. And it was amazing. And it's like my favorite John Denver song that I've ever heard. I can't tell you the name of it cause I don't remember. But I mean, he had such a great and sort of gentle demeanor in his music that, he really just like gave off that vibe of like, hey, you know, let's just sit back and be happy with where we are.
There are three people I can think of who have that sort of just strange, quiet appreciation for the beauty of existence. Mm-hmm. And that's like John Denver, Bob Ross, and Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Are kind of all in the same vein right there. But John Denver could play music to express himself.
Yeah.
So Carl Sagan, the scientist, the other two artists. There you go.
Yeah. And of course, John Denver was amazing in Oh God. So
he really was.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of insight on his plane.
Okay, go ahead.
So it wasn't quite an ultralight. But it was a glider that did have a powered engine on it.
Yeah.
And to save weight and space, the engine was one of those like push props.
Yeah.
That sat above and behind your head.
Yeah.
And that was also where the fuel tanks were. And rather than having a wiring harness to move switches down on where his instrumentation was.
Mm-hmm.
The switch to switch between two fuel tanks was up above his head. So he had to stand up and turn around to flip that switch.
Mm.
So the FAA in their investigation, what they believe happened was that he was, because they know how much fuel he left with, because that's on
Flight manifest?
Yeah, your manifest.
Flight log, yeah.
they know that he had to switch tanks at some point. He didn't have enough to get to where he was going, so he would have had to stand up and switch that. And they think that he probably hit the stick with his knee as he was getting up and dumped himself into the ocean.
Oh.
So when he said he ran out of gas, technically he didn't like completely run out of fuel.
It's not like he ran out of gas and then crashed,
right,
per se. It was just that was maybe part of the reason why things went the way they did.
Yeah. So after that, I'm pretty sure they made some regulations where I remember at the time there was like an argument on whether or not there should be like a disconnector on your flight controls, which sounds scary as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh yeah, I'm just going to disconnect my flight controls so I can't accidentally use them and dump myself into the ocean.
But, you know, though, if you've ever gone up in like a Cessna or something, that's the thing too, is it's kind of like a car. If you let go and nobody's flying, you just continue to go straight.
I mean like it would have been probably different had he been like at sort of a high altitude or something, you know, but he probably,
well, the other thing is you're not strapped in and you're not sitting down, you're standing up, so if the plane tips over, you're no longer in the seat, you're getting thrown around the fuselage.
Wow. That would suck.
Yeah, that would be terrifying. Terrifying way to go out.
That's a sad way to go. I didn't even know.
I didn't mean to make that story worse.
No, but it's some good insight to really understand what happened. Because, I mean, you know, you hear about it, but I didn't know That was, it was like that.
I remember some hack comedians at the time making jokes about, like, oh, you know, everyone talks about, like, how clever a man John Denver is, but, you know, he doesn't know how much fuel he needs to fly somewhere. And
jokes in poor taste are always,
I don't care if it's poor taste, just make it accurate to the facts, I guess.
And yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's and it's really low-hanging fruit. I mean,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, hey, so here's an interesting story. In 2003, and we saw the video before the show started.
Yes.
And I got to say, it was awesome. So, not the 2003 version, but the blind Puerto Rican singer Jose Feliciano performs the Star Spangled Banner for the first time since his flavorful rendition at a Tigers Cards World Series game in 1968.
Yeah.
68 performance is the one we were watching. It was awesome. So his performance in Miami at the Marlins Cubs playoff game goes off without a incident.
Yeah.
Goes off without a hitch.
So,
as you say,
we listened to Jose's version in 68, and I loved that version because it was really, really good, and that dude's just got a fantastic voice. For those of you who also don't know, he is the man who recorded the song that is heard every year.
Mm-hmm.
Feliz Navidad. So that's how most people
Feliz
would recognize.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.
So yes.
Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad.
Which translates to,
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
All right.
I guess that's where we were going.
Well, yeah, you know that was going to happen.
So he did Feliz Navidad. But yes, he did the Star Spangled Banner, and it was amazing. So here's my question to the three of us then. What other famous artist's rendition of the Star Spangled Banner is on par?
Ooh. What are you asking?
I'm asking, like, other musicians who did the Star Spangled Banner in a cool way, like, which ones are the best? What are the best renditions of the Star Spangled Banner?
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
At the end of Woodstock?
That's a really good one. That's a really good one.
I'd say to go with that one, you could have Slash's version as well, which was super cool.
Mm-hmm.
That he did at an actual game. I would say if you're going to make a top, like, five list or whatever, you got to have Whitney Houston at the Super Bowl, because that was just super great.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have Marvin Gaye on there, because Marvin Gaye's version was just so smooth.
He can sing whatever he wants.
That was just great. And then, but who else would, like, round out this list?
I'm going to say James Brown.
Mm.
Saying the Star Spangled Banner at the Muhammad Ali versus Chuck Wepner fight.
Ooh.
I had to look up what fight it was. I couldn't remember if it was that or the Rumble in the Jungle. But it was Chuck Wepner.
Huey Lewis and the News did a version.
Yep. You're welcome for that, by the way.
Yes. That was them doing a cappella, like, with multi-harmonies and stuff.
Barbershop
like that.
Quartet style.
Yes. Yeah, although it wasn't a quartet, there was like eight of them.
Well, okay.
So.
Fine, barbershop.
But yeah, barbershop style.
Nuftet.
Can you think of any other ones?
I'm racking my brain here. It's not a lot of great ones, because I think it was like Alicia Keys or somebody did a really beautiful rendition. But like that, at the same time, that's still in that vein of like the version that a lot of people do, you know, where they just kind of draw it out a little bit.
Yes.
But she did a great job.
Honestly, like, because I kind of went down the YouTube rabbit hole when I was like looking at this stuff. One of the best versions that I actually came across was Jack Black doing the Star Spangled Banner.
Okay.
And the reason why is because, well, he did it straightforward. He wasn't trying to be goofy. He wasn't trying to do anything. He was legitimately singing the Star Spangled Banner, and he nailed it. Like, so good. So there you go. I'd say there's a good grouping of people. If our listeners have not heard any of these other versions of them, definitely go check them out. I'd say Jose Feliciano, Marvin Gaye, go ahead and check out Huey Lewis as well. Why not? Then you got to go for Jimi Hendrix on guitar
Whitney Houston just power vocaling our national anthem. And that's all I got. All
right.
So, moving on to October 13th, 1935, born on this day, the great and powerful Luciano Pavarotti, the Italian singer, of course, had a massive career in opera singing. He was known as the King of High C's because he could hit a high C while singing. I have discovered I can hit a high C. It just hurts to do it. So there you go. But, I mean, obviously, very, very famous for Nessun Dorma, which is like one of the greatest opera pieces ever written. And, I mean, I've heard so many versions of Nessun Dorma. Mm-hmm. I've heard, you know, like people on one of those British talent shows do Nessun Dorma. And, like, I've heard Bono do it. I've heard, you know, all sorts of people do it. Still, to me, Pavarotti's is the best.
Have you heard, and I know I just brought up this artist, but I'm going to say it anyway. Have you heard Pavarotti do It's a Man's World with James Brown?
No.
It is amazing. James Brown comes out, does the first verse. They sing the chorus together. And then Pavarotti does the second verse of It's a Man's World in Italian.
Wow. Cool.
It's so, you would think worlds apart on the spectrum of like things that would go together. Not so much.
Yeah.
All right. I'll put it on
I've always wanted to legitimately learn how to sing Nessun Dorma.
Yeah.
Wow, that was horrible.
Thank you. I didn't try.
That was pretty close. And real,
yeah, because like, no, I'm not. I don't. You know what? Let's get me a tuning. What do you call the
tuning fork?
No. The
one of the little harps.
What? Okay, so classical musicians, they have the little like whistle that they blow.
Yeah.
That, like to tune
pitch pipe.
That's it. I was thinking like a tuning harp.
Yeah, let's give me a pitch pipe and like I don't know 6 months of lessons, and I'll come back here and I'll give you the first four notes. How's that sound?
Nessun Dorma. That's about.
It's not even in my head to do, man. Like
Nessun Dorma, because he drops down the octave. And that's all I know. That's the only line of the song I can actually. I can do the music part. I can't. I don't know what the lyrics are.
I'm all over that key change, though.
So, let's go ahead and move on. Jumping up to another great musician, born on this day in 1941. Paul Simon is born in Newark, New Jersey.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. Paul Simon's Graceland album is still one of my favorite albums because it's just like weirdly cool.
I think his appearance on Sesame Street was one of my top ones.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Just listening to him do songs with like the band and then Ladysmith Black Mambazo together. Like him doing Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, you know?
Yeah.
God. She's a rich girl. Don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
You have no idea how badly Lady Scratch wants to be talking about this right now.
What is she big
She's
on?
She's a huge Paul Simon fan.
Oh, man.
We actually have a lot of his albums laying around the house.
So, I mean, well, then we got to get her on to do the Graceland album.
Yeah, a album review. That'd be perfect.
I mean, that'll be great. Because that's the album I know the most about anyway, as far as his stuff goes.
I think...
But.
Lady Scratch, come back.
Have you heard the story of Paul Simon traveling to South Africa before writing the Graceland album?
Yeah, I've heard the entire story. He was given a tape by a friend of his or the producer who was Ladysmith Black Mambazo and was like, "Hey, you got to listen to this." Plays it and he's just like, "This is amazing." But in true Paul Simon fashion, He doesn't necessarily know what they're singing, but he hears the music of what they're singing. Yeah. And so when he even later on tries to get them to record on stuff, he's like, hey, I need you to do this sound. And they're like, what are you talking about? And for them, it's a word, you know, it actually has meaning behind what they're saying. And so he's like, you know, in your one song, you did this like vocal part. Oh, okay. Yeah, we can do that. And it was something like so trivial, but he was basically like, you know, you've got to do like, please do this for me for this particular song. And it's on Diamonds on the Soles of Their Shoes. It's when they're singing in the background and they do this little part and then they go, wah, wah. Like that part, it's like, I love that part. So.
Well, I heard him tell a funny story about when he was in South Africa, and he was just like walking out on the town one day, and he was kind of humming, you know, a melody to himself or whatever. And he sat down and started like talking to some kids that were just in the street being children. And one of the kids heard him humming and kind of like hummed along with him. And he started to talk to a translator, and he's like, he realized that the kid had like more or less perfect pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked the kid, like, you know, do you play any instruments or anything? Because he thought, well, you know, the kid's got perfect pitch. I could go and buy him a recorder or something and give him an instrument. He goes, oh, yeah, he plays. So the kid's like, I want to play something for you. So he goes and gets a little, like, I think it's called a harmonium.
Yeah,
it's a little piano with reeds in it, and there's an airbag that you pump.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the kid pulls out a piece of sheet music, puts it up in front of the harmonium. And just before he started to play, Paul Simon realized that the sheet music that he had put out was The Sounds of Silence.
Oh, nice.
So this kid played Paul Simon his own song.
Wow.
Like in South Africa, in the apartheid, in the goddamn apartheid state. Yeah. Like music, yes. Music finds a way. Also, so, Paul Simon, only person I've ever heard talk bad about him is Art Garfunkel.
Yeah,
which says something. Like,
I don't know, man. Because Los Lobos, they had a track on Graceland album too, and they were none too happy with him after the fact. Yeah, because apparently, like, they didn't get paid for it, like, and like didn't get credit on the album or anything. And apparently, some of the band members too that he hired from South Africa, like, there were some money issues and stuff that like stuff wasn't paid out. Like, there's a little bit of a seedier side to that, but at the same time, that album did a massive amount at getting recognition for like what apartheid actually was in South Africa. I'm not saying Paul Simon like basically like started the end of it.
Right.
But at the same time, he got a lot of like world recognition for that. And but I love it because the Graceland album to me is just it's essentially a perfect album. It's got some of the best lines. It's got the greatest music that I've ever heard, like from the artist, you know. So it's like, and made me instantly like want to go out and search for more South African artists. And I'm still following Ladysmith Black Mambazo to this day. So.
Is it bad that you just reminded me of Russell Brand singing African Child from Get Him to the Greek? Oh, but Paul Simon, fantastic dude. A lot of good stuff.
Yes.
And Art Garfunkel, I always feel like you should have shaved your head. I feel like you just would have been a better looking dude.
Let's go ahead and move on to 1973, a sad day for the music and entertainment world when the great and just powerful man...
The great and powerful.
Ed Sullivan dies at the age of 73. Mm. So that man introduced so many great acts and artists and tons of other people like to the American audience. It's ridiculous. That man probably has had more of an impact on our culture than like most of the musicians that he actually introduced.
Yeah, it's crazy when you have somebody who can actually make or break your career. You know, when you have that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm.
Say, hey, come on my show and, you know, America will take care of the rest for you.
Yep.
Yeah, the Ed Sullivan Show probably had more cultural impact than, like, some networks did while it was running.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. So, sad day, Ed Sullivan dies at the age of 73 in 1973. So, a little bit of math check.
Mm-hmm.
That means that he was born in 1900.
Yeah, and it makes it really easy to keep track of your age that way, too.
That is
true.
You
know what? I just realized I typed that out wrong.
What?
He died in 1974.
Oh, Jake.
Yeah. Dang
Jake
it.
Ruining the segment.
I know. All I,
you know bad. What? There's only one thing left to do. Greg, give us our last fact of the day.
Hey, Greg.
Yes.
Have you ever wanted to be an MTV VJ?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember when MTV used to have a new show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever want to be part of that?
Sure.
Well, now's your chance.
Young.
Now's your chance to live that out, buddy.
All right. Well, in 1998, the Frasier Fair kicks off. According to MTV back in 98, quote, feeling left out of the all-female Lilith Fair phenomenon, singer-songwriter Steve Poltz has initiated what he calls the Frasier Fair Tour. The outing takes its name from the TV character Frasier, whose ex-wife is named Lilith, although the Sarah McLachlan Tour actually takes the name Lilith from a biblical character.
Hold on. Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Toss salad and scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
Continue.
Okay. So, Poltz is perhaps known best as Jewel's co-writer, ex-boyfriend, and the mysterious man in her You Were Meant For Me video. Pete, how do you pronounce Pete's last name?
Droge?
Yeah, I'd say it.
D-R-O-G-E. Yeah, I never know if you pronounce the E or not. Glenn Phillips of the now defunct Toad the Wet Sprocket and X's John Doe have been recruited for the first leg of the Frasier Fair. A second tour with a different lineup began then in December 12th in San Diego. Poltz told MTV News that the tour was meant as an homage to Lilith Fair, and he would love to advertise the tour with, quote, a banner of Kelsey Grammer with wings coming out of his head. However, he admits that no one from NBC, the network that lords over the Frasier Manor, has returned his calls.
Oh. So,
he wants it to be Frasier so bad. No, but cool stuff.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it. That's the final fact of the show.
Yeah. And we got the Frasier theme in there too.
Yeah, I've always liked Frasier. I always thought it was a funny show.
See, so nobody's going home empty-handed this
that
time.
Is true.
I went through and read like some quotes from Frasier.
Yeah,
and it's so bad.
Oh yeah,
like the writing of it is so terrible.
The show.
I mean, it's really hard.
Flow well though. I mean, I know it was supposed to be like smart humor.
Honestly, not trying to shit on it because, like, writing a network comedy, you know, a sitcom, has to be one of the hardest jobs in the world. Like, trying to get a joke through a censor, network censor, has to be the most frustrating thing you can do next to try and, like, I don't know, move a barrel of beans with toothpicks. I don't like
just so, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
More randomness. Go on.
Sorry. anyway,
it's like moving a barrel of beans with a toothpick. I tell you what,
you don't know frustration until you try to move a barrel of beans with a toothpick.
All righty,
that's the end of the show.
That's
done.
Okay. That's a closing point right there.
On a high note.
Either way, folks, thanks for listening to Follow the Sound. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. Once again, if you want to help out the show, go to our website and click on the Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon and do all of your normal shopping and give us a little bit of money back just for going through our site. Won't cost you anything extra. It's super simple, easy, and yeah, that's it. Also want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. Check out other great programs. We have talked about several on the show tonight. Two Birds on a Bat with Jim Cromer, Steve Flowers, Nate McHenry, Fish, and Benji Molina. Any combination of those guys on that show at any given time. Of course, you can check out Surreal Talk with Eric and Everett Hicks, which is fantastic. If you actually go back and listen to their episode, The Day the Music Died, or Did It? Jake and I are on that episode, and it was a fun show to do.
Or are we?
And I'm looking forward to doing it again. And we'll have Everett on our show here in a bit to do an album review with us. But yeah, check out any of the other programs that we have at lineupmedia.fm. We've got some exciting things coming up in the future just for our show. And of course, we will bring those up whenever they actually come into fruition. But trust me, some exciting things are happening for our show, and hopefully be helping us to take off and get even more listeners. But once again, I have been your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
Sleep is for people without social lives.
And Greg Harvey.
Here I go again.
I don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. But remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.